I'm the executive director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and this is my 12th day in that position, so I look forward to being before this subcommittee on a regular basis, it sounds like, and also meeting with members on their own issues as they come up. Doug Thomas is with me. He's the assistant director, and Doug has been carrying the load on the budget, and also he's a point person in the agency on the Clean Water Legacy implementation, so he'll speak in more detail about that part of our budget and our programs. I just wanted to give a little bit of bigger picture perspective on the agency and what we do. Probably most of you know, but it's managed by a board appointed by the governor, 17 members representing conservation, soil water conservation district, watershed districts, counties, citizens, and then 5 members who are representing state agencies. We have a number of responsibilities, and I'll briefly cover those, and we'll go into more detail on future subcommittee meetings, I'm quite sure. We have a grant responsibility. We provide grants to local governments to administer conservation and environmental protection programs, and those are done as a way to leverage the state's resources. The local governments are also required to, in most cases, match that with their own funding. We've had a long-standing easement acquisition program, a Reinvest in Minnesota program being at the core of that, which does acquiring of private land interest to accomplish wetland restoration and establish buffers, and it has been very successful in leveraging other funding, especially federal farm bill funding under the CRP or CREP or CREP program. The Wetland Conservation Act is also part of the agency's responsibility. That responsibility directs us to protect the existing wetlands of the state, approximately 10 million acres remaining. That responsibility includes a training endeavor, technical assistance of local governments, as well as a dispute resolution function that the agency provides when local governments and citizens believe a decision has been made that could benefit them further review rather than going through the court system. More recently, we've, in the last couple of years, spent some time focusing on the public drainage systems, and there'll be more to report on that in the upcoming meetings, I'm quite sure. But the responsibility there is to look at the water conveyance systems that drain land for primarily agricultural production, but also other purposes, and to make sure that those are well managed by the counties and watershed districts. And finally, the most recent area of responsibility falls into the Clean Water Legacy Act implementation. The new framework that was established in last year's legislation, as well as the initial funding, has been rolled out, and there will be continued funding expected as part of the decisions that are going to be made during this legislative session. And Doug is going to give you a little bit of background on the, what has happened previously and how that connects to the federal mandates to do TMDLs, or total maximum daily load planning and implementation. And again, thank you for your time, and I expect to be back here on a regular basis. I should note that in the packets I provided a very short introduction to myself and contact information in terms of being able to get a hold of me, and I've spoken with both your assistants there, and they've got my contact information. So I can note for the record that I was raised in the Doty district up in central Minnesota, and my family farm is still in that area. So I've got to talk to him once already, and I expect to maybe do that on occasion again. So thank you for your time.
It's the big business card in the folder.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
Representative. To Mr. Jasky, I noted that we have the exact same education background.
Really?
Well, except for geophysics, geology, and MBA. So it's good to see that.
I hope you use more of it than I do, but
I would like to.
Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Jasky? Members, we just handed out the Clean Water Legacy packet is in your packet, and Mr. Jasky has just given an overview, a short overview of Bowser. I would note for the record, we do have a quorum. Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Doug Thomas, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Thank you, and try to give a fairly concise and manageable amount of time overview on kind of our activities relating to the Clean Water Legacy. As John mentioned, I just want to point out a few of the things that we'll be kind of speaking from. The first one is an agency profile and provided that so provide some context in terms of all of the programs that Bowser is responsible for implementing, and John went over most of those. You also have a copy, I believe, that did that get put in the packets? Yeah, okay, great. That is a copy of a PowerPoint that Galen Reach from the PCA and myself did, and I just want to touch on a couple things within that. Basically, the Clean Water Legacy Act, which passed last year, it really was kind of a twofold effort looking at the restoration of waters that are impaired, as well as the protection of waters in the state that are not impaired. And so that was really kind of the major distinction between the Act. On the restoration side, the focus of that, and it's the second slide on the first page, really speaks to that that came out of a Federal Clean Water Act requirement where states are required to assess their waters. Waters that are found to be impaired are required to be listed on what is known as the 303D list, or the impaired waters list. Once they're listed, then the state is supposed to make reasonable progress towards the development of TMDL plans. And those are the plans that I think we've heard a lot about when people talk about TMDLs. It's basically a plan which starts out with a two-year, generally a two-year intense monitoring period to verify the impairment that was identified, and the water was listed from that condition and assessment monitoring that is done, which identifies those waters, a verification process, and then a scientific process to allocate the load or the pollutant load that is causing that impairment back to the sources. So it could be municipal sources, it could be agricultural sources, forestry sources, a number of different, many different sources. And when we think of those conventional pollutants, it's things like nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, fecal coliform are some of the principal ones, dissolved oxygen, and there's some other minor ones, but those are really the major ones. And then that plan is also is required to put together an implementation plan, a plan that basically says what are the things that actually would need to be done to reduce those pollutants so that that water then ultimately is achieving water quality standards. There's effectiveness monitoring required, and once that monitoring can demonstrate that those implementation activities have reduced the loading to those levels that are identified, then there's a process by which that water can be delisted. And so within that process, and I kind of touched on so the four parts that the Clean Water Legacy Act really dealt with, and I want to emphasize it's a multi-agency effort that looked at kind of all of these various responsibilities. The first one is monitoring and assessment. That's the condition monitoring that is done on an annual basis across the state to assess the condition of our waters, and then if there are impairments that are identified, that begins that listing process. PCA and the DNR are the two primary lead agencies on the monitoring and assessment. Next is the TMDL development, and the lead agency on that is really the Pollution Control Agency, although much of the work that is done by local governments who basically contract with them to take over the responsibility of leading a TMDL, finding contractors, doing the science, and putting together the plan. All of those plans ultimately come back, require federal approval and state approval on those TMDL implementation plans. The third category is basically, and fourth categories, focus back on implementation. Actually making those changes and implementing those projects and practices which reduce those pollutants so that ultimately we can get to the point of taking these waters back off that impaired waters list. The first area is non-point source activities. Those generally are the non-regulated activities as compared to the point sources, which are the regulated activities. Point sources, you can think of a municipal wastewater, discharges from factories or industry. In some instances, some municipal systems are considered point sources, as well as feedlots, which are regulated under the Environmental Protection Act. The non-point things are those agricultural, forestry, rural development, erosion control from construction site activities. Those make up that kind of broad category of non-point source pollution. And basically, the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Department of Ag are the two kind of principal agencies that focus our efforts in that non-point source implementation. And on the point source side, it basically is the PCA along with the Public Facilities Authority that makes money available through a priority list to municipal type activities. And so I think that is probably about as much time we provided you again with that PowerPoint to give you some additional background and kind of how things break out regarding the various activities, the types of things that are done there, and the amount of resources that were made available last year. What I'd like to do is shift to a one-page piece of paper that you have, which has got some boxes on it, and I'd like to kind of use this as a starting point before we launch into kind of the Bowser-specific activities. And this breaks down for you what the funding was in FY07, which was one-time funding appropriated by the legislature, a combination of general fund and bonding, which totaled $24.95 million. I believe about $15 million of that was general fund, and the balance of it was bonding. And you can see approximately how that money was allocated to the monitoring and assessment, $2.14 million. TMDL studies, 3.17, non-point source restoration and protection, just a little over $11 million, and the point source restoration and protection is 8.4. And then as far as what is in the governor's budget recommendations for this year is $20 million of general fund, and you can, again, kind of quickly see how that splits out into the various activities. I think if you look at it, the percentages are very similar to what you saw in FY07 as the agencies worked with the administration this past fall to kind of put together a package. We provided the administration a number of different alternatives and some different scales of activity, and this reflects what the administration chose to move forward with. The two probably differences are the TMDL studies really ramping up from 3.17 to 9.57. The rationale behind that is that once a water is put on the impaired waters list, the economic development impact is that no new or expanded discharges are allowed to be permitted by the Pollution Control Agency until the TMDL study is completed. And that goes back to the Maple Lake Annandale situation that we all became so well aware of last year. That's still being litigated. I think people have kind of quit holding their breath right now for the Supreme Court to make a decision, but ultimately they will come out with a decision on that. But really what that court case basically said is the agency was no longer able to do offsetting and that they could not permit those two facilities until the Lake Pepin TMDL study was done. And so with the impaired waters list, gets larger every couple of years when additional waters are listed, and it was the feeling that we really needed to get and start attacking all of those backlog of impaired waters and to get that TMDL study process underway so that we can start to remove some of that economic development impact from that prohibition on new and expanded discharges. And again, those are point sources. Wastewater treatment, it could be ethanol facilities, it could be a number of facilities that discharge basically out of a pipe into a receiving body. It could be a lake, river, or stream. And then the other one is on the point source restoration and protection. Almost all of that can be done through bonding because it is money that goes to municipal projects, municipal wastewater upgrades. And so the idea was is to basically hold off and to pick that up in the bonding bill in the next go-around was kind of the philosophy there. So that kind of gives you kind of the lay of the land as it relates to what was funded last year, that allocation, and what the governor's budget recommendation is for this year.
Just kind of going in this process, on that, last year we heard a lot of the G16, which was the informal group that was preparing this, and then also we authorized the Clean Water Council. Can you just give an update on the status of those two groups and what's happening before you move into the Bowser?
Okay. Certainly. G16 got that name because it basically was 16 groups that initially got together and began deliberating over the need to address impaired waters. Again, the chamber, you know, recognizing the economic development aspects. So the G16 represented a broad range of organizations and interests, all the way from industry to agriculture to the environmental organizations, the conservation organizations, local governments. And basically they worked for a number of years talking about, well, how do we go about addressing the issue of impaired waters, recognizing that the backlog was getting greater and the liabilities, if you think of it that way, were getting greater as well in terms of some of the potential for economic development being stopped or restricted because of that federal requirement. They came together over about a 2.5-year period a year ago with basically a recommendation to fund the activities that we just went through, the condition monitoring and assessment, the TMDL studies, and then begin the non-point source implementation and the point source implementation, and ultimately recommended a package of about $80 million that was based on a fee that would have been generated from every individual property that was either connected to a wastewater facility or had an individual sewage treatment system. And I think that became affectionately known as the flush tax. And so that was really the work of G16. They continue to meet on an informal basis, primarily to continue to talk about how they work together as organizations to support moving forward this year in the discussions about needs and funding and to bring their perspectives back to the table. And I'm sure at some point in the future, representatives from that group would be more than happy to come and talk about where they're currently at and some of what their thinking is in terms of their priorities and some of what they continue to believe are the needs there in the program. One of the things that the Act did was create a Clean Water Legacy Council. And the council actually mirrors the organizations that were represented on G16, business, agriculture, conservation, environmental organizations, and the state agencies and local government. That council, 15 of the 19 members have been appointed, and their first meeting is scheduled to take place on March 19th. At which time they will kind of officially form and begin to operate. The purposes that the council was established for in the Act were to look at a body that would do a couple things. One is receive reports back on the activity as well as the legislature on what has been done, how is the money getting spent, what is the accomplishments, but also then also to look at the needs, to talk about the priorities in terms of where should money be spent. You know, is the amounts right between condition monitoring versus point source implementation? And then also to recommend to the governor a budget and a spending plan for future appropriations surrounding the Clean Water Legacy Act. And so that's really kind of where a little bit of history and where those two groups are presently at. We included a couple of things for you, and I will focus on basically the governor's recommendation for the Clean Water Legacy Act. We also included other change items that were included or in the governor's recommendation for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And this starts getting at basically where our involvement comes, and that is working with the state's 91 soil and water conservation districts, our counties through our county local water management program, in cities and towns in the metropolitan area through our Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act, and then watershed districts statewide, connecting up with those local implementers and providing assistance to them both financially and technically to help them develop and implement and carry out projects and programs that directly relate back to the restoration and protection of water resources in the state. And basically, the budget change item that you have in front of you is a little bit less than what was appropriated the previous year, which was $5.84 million. The governor's recommendation is for $5.45 million per year, or 10.9 for the biennium. And we categorized that implementation into some defined activities, and that really kind of came at the behest of the legislature last year to be able to get a sense of how is this money being spent that's going out the door, what's supporting and what's it buying. We continue to include that same kind of categorization this year. And as you can see, the $10.9 million, $3 million is for targeted non-point restoration cost sharing incentive payments. And basically those are incentive payments or cost share payments to individual landowners to actually offset a portion of their cost of implementing the erosion control and water quality protection projects. And that could be agricultural, forestry, or urban non-point. And again, it really depends on the individual TMDL and the individual sources of the pollutants. And I'll touch on a little bit of how that was prioritized this last year in a little bit. We also have a great ability to leverage federal farm bill conservation programs, such as one that I think you've heard about is the Environmental Quality Incentive Program. That's kind of a fix-it-up program that USDA has. Unfortunately, in the 2002 farm bill, they reduced the amount of cost share on the most expensive projects from 75% to 50%. The landowner is always responsible for a minimum of 25% of the cost of these projects. So some of those projects like gully control structures, grass waterways, terraces, stream bank stabilization, because that cost share dropped from 75% to 50%, it really has curtailed landowners' interest in implementing those projects on their lands because of the high cost of those and the limited amount. We have the ability to go in there and piggyback with those federal funds, state funds, and that landowner contribution, making that package a little bit more attractive, so to speak, for the individual landowners, where they have been identified as part of the contribution of pollutants, and the practices that are contributing to that would benefit both the TMDL and also on that individual property. For example, extreme bank erosion project, crop residue management, nutrient management, any number of those kind of agricultural best management practices that we commonly refer to. Obviously, this is a very targeted. It's not money that is just made available statewide. The idea is that it's targeted to those TMDLs for those projects and practices that are going to have the greatest impact and the greatest buy for the investment in terms of reducing that particular pollutant of concern. And we propose to utilize our state soil and water conservation districts to serve as the local administrator of that program, similar to the board's regular cost share program. It's a long-established, run program that they have where they initiate contracts with landowners, have written agreements, require annual or inspections every 3 years. So it's a very robust program that has been put in place over a number of years. The next area would be $4 million for targeted non-point restoration, technical compliance, and engineering assistance, acknowledging that much of what the need is out there is to provide that technical assistance through those local governments to those landowners to help them with the survey, the design, and the construction, inspection, and supervision that's necessary to make sure that those projects are designed and meet federal and state standards that are in place, as well as to assure that the state is getting what it paid for over the course of the contract or the length of the agreement that is in place with those individual landowners. And kind of, again, tying this back a little bit to some of the federal programs, earlier this year, you had Mr. Bill Hunt, who's the state conservationist from the Natural Resources Conservation Service in, and Minnesota is faced right now with just about a $4.5 million backlog in technical assistance just to deliver the federal projects that are out there, let alone state projects and local projects. And so this will, in fact, help us deal with some of that technical backlog so that we're able to maximize and leverage those federal farm program dollars right alongside with resources or the money that is going to be made available through the Clean Water Legacy as well as some of our regular cost share activities.
Mr. Thomas, just a second. You're on this particular sheet.
Actually, I am on the sheet. It's got a gray banner on the top, and it says starts with Board of Water and Soil Resources and says program and then change item Clean Water Legacy Act. Apologize if I didn't direct you into the right place. The third category of activity for us is request for $400,000 over the biennium to support reporting and evaluation of those land applied stormwater conservation practices. And we do that
We have two different sheets in our packet. You have one that's that has the old 5840, that's the two page gray one, and then there's the black top one that you open up and it has the same Water and Soil Resources Board change item with 5450.
That's the correct one.
5450.
And I apologize, we provided the older one so you could have reference to what was done last year. And this was basically the initiative that we submitted, which was built around what we had received in FY07. On the reporting evaluation, this to basically support two activities. One is the annual reporting back to the board, which is required as part of any of our grants, where when projects are applied, the local government has to report to us the location of the project, the type of project to practice, and the estimated pollution reduction benefits from that. And right now, those basically are soil loss, sediment, and phosphorus reductions that are attributed to that practice. And that's a process that we worked on a number of years ago. The original work was done in the state of Michigan through the U.S. Department of Agriculture through their Agricultural Research Service. We brought that to Minnesota and assembled a group of state agency staff, and we modified and fine-tuned those estimates for Minnesota conditions. They are estimates, but we feel it gives us a very good way to look at which projects are providing the greatest benefit for, and also looking at what the cost of that is per, so the efficiency of implementing grass waterways versus another practice where you might get much more pollution reduction benefit and do it for less money. So it allows us to do some of that comparison and help with some of the planning. Then the other thing we also are interested in is continuing to support the actual effectiveness monitoring with these projects. And that's the in-stream monitoring that goes along with the reduction or the reporting of estimates to us. And as we've talked to folks, we really feel we need both parts. We need to look at, are we accomplishing those land use changes, and so that we can track those and report progress on them. Because in some cases, it's been reported to us that by staff from PC and others that sometimes it can take multiple years before you start seeing the result of those practices in the water column. And so we want to combine both annual reporting as well as effectiveness monitoring so that over the course of a TMDL implementation period, most of the plans talk about a 10-year period of time, and that's kind of what they lay out their implementation plans, so that we can kind of chart our progress, see whether or not we're achieving the land use goals that have been laid out or established in the implementation plans, as well as are we making a difference in the water column, which is critical to taking those waters off the list at some point in time. And there's $1.5 million for implementation of county individual sewage treatment programs, and that was something that the PCA in the original development of this is recognizing that non-conforming individual sewage treatment systems can be a considerable source of pollutants, both fecal and nutrients, particularly during low flow conditions in our rivers and streams. And so this was money to help counties who have adopted the state ISTS ordinance and regulation, help them implement that so they can further the inspections and the enforcement of these non-conforming septic systems that are identified at the county level. And then lastly, $2 million to support local non-point source protection activities related to lake and river protection and management. This is the piece that is different from the restoration. This is the piece of money that is that we've identified to support protection activities, those activities that local government, lake associations, others might engage in with the goal of keeping waters that are clean, clean, rather than waiting until they become impaired and then having to enter into the whole TMDL process and then start addressing land use changes, soil conservation practices, and the like. So that is a quick summary of what is in the governor's recommended budget. And the last thing I would like to do is the other packet of material is the FY07 Clean Water Legacy Program funding recommendation, and was asked to speak a little bit about how that process worked this last year for the board in terms of how we actually went about implementing that money. And the first thing that you notice on here is that it includes the Department of Ag, Bowser, PCA, and DNR. And I really think that was one of the successes of the Clean Water Legacy Act, which really set out a goal for the agencies to work together. And this is the first time in 17 years that I've worked for the state where we actually had the agencies, the Department of Ag with the Ag BNP loan program dollars that they received, with the Board of Water and Soil Resources with a number of those things that I just mentioned, the Pollution Control Agency with federal Section 319 grants, which are for restoration of impaired waters, and then DNR received some money for protection activities through their Forest Stewardship Program. We worked together and through our board ended up getting agreement from the agencies on having an interagency process for a request for proposal, and then an interagency process to review, rank, and make project selections for funding. And that worked extremely well, in my estimation, this last year. And basically, the second page goes over some of the funding recommendations. We had a little over $44 million in requests, and that came in response to a request for proposal period that was less than, or just about 60 days. So a tremendous response, I think, speaks to the need and the desire on the part of our local government partners out there to their appetite for getting financial assistance to help with the implementation of both restoration and protection activities. We had $7.81 million available through that combined process. We basically limited it to what somebody could reasonably implement in a two-year period of time. The highest ranking projects received the highest funding priority. We gave funding priority to activities that applied BMPs, and I probably shouldn't use the word dirt moving. That's one we tend to use, but some people think that is a negative. When we think about it, it's actually building the projects that are going to actually result in measurable reductions of pollutants. Any funding for ISTS upgrades that were requested were given the lowest priority, and actually no grant money was provided for that activity. The only money that was provided for IST upgrades was loan money, which is consistent with, I think, the state's policy for how we approach funding for individual sewage treatment system upgrades that are found to be non-conforming. Requests for restoration activities that weren't identified in the TMDL plan were not funded, and then the Ag BMP loan funds were widely distributed with higher amounts allocated to higher projects. The third page in there, and I won't go over this, is just a quick summary for you of the total number of applications and the dollars requested between the restoration projects and the protection projects. And following that is a detailed three pages or so of spreadsheets which actually show the projects in priority order And then the allocation that was made between the various pots of money that were brought to the table by each of the agencies, and it splits those between restoration and protection. And then the last page on there is a map which just gives you some geographic perspective regarding where money went and the number and kind of the different types of LGUs in terms of county, soil and water district, city, joint powers boards, and watershed districts gives you some sense of the number of applications that were funded from those individuals. And again, as you look at like that upper right-hand corner, we really encourage watershed approaches to restoration, and most of our TMDLs in the state are in the southern half of the state right now. And if you basically, where we are at this year is that based on PCA's information, there were going to be 12 TMDLs studies that would have had federally approved and state approved local implementation plans. So that was the priority for this year. That list will continue to grow as we move forward. I think right now, next year, they're predicting, I think, another 10 studies to be completed and approved. And as we continue to do more, the list of ones that would be approved and eligible for restoration funds were there. I think just lastly, in terms of the split, 64% of the money went for restoration, and 36% went for protection activities, which is very consistent with kind of the allocation that was agreed to in the 07 funding package. And so that's kind of a general overview of a little bit of the history, kind of the multi-agency, the parts, and then the board's role in implementing our portion of that this past year.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Mr. Thomas? Mr. Wagenius?
One of the things you don't split out here, because you had cash and no bonding, were any of these proposals that you funded bondable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Agulius, for the non-point source portion of it, they were not. And that's primarily because these are projects that occur on private land. And in order to spend bonding dollars, at least general obligation bonds, requires a public interest in the property. By comparison, almost all of the money that the PFA received, which went into the municipal or point source side, was bonding. So probably the only projects that have a potential to be bonded would be large, probably some of the larger stream bank stabilization projects where it may involve a road authority where there is already an existing public interest, or where a public entity may be willing to go in and acquire a public interest and then fund the restoration or the implementation of a project or practice.
Representative Wagenius.
Perhaps my better question would have been of the 44 million? Could you just make any kind of estimate if any of that was bondable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Agulius, this particular RFP was for non-point source pollution. The municipal projects, looking at it, we had cities apply for seven projects, or seven projects were funded for $702,000. It's possible that some of those projects, particularly if it was, some of those projects were like retrofitting some existing infrastructure to enhance its pollution reduction capabilities. It's possible that some of those could be because they might coincide with city-owned property or where the city actually has a controlling interest in those sites. So the municipal projects would probably be the ones that would likely have been potentially eligible for use of bonding.
Any other questions? Mr. Thomas, I had one, just taking like the first ranking one, a Fillmore SWCD restoration dollars. So can you just follow a dollar through what would happen? So a check for $75,000 gets written to the Fillmore SWCD, and then a landowner has a project and applies, or can you just follow a dollar through getting into the ground?
Sure. In the, with the two agencies, you know, between the Department of Ag and Balzer, you're going to find very similar processes. In the case of the Fillmore SWCD, it was $75,000 of Ag BMP loan money that was going to them. That's Southeast Minnesota. Their TMDL is a fecal coliform TMDL. So the loan money that they were requesting is to provide loan dollars to ag waste management systems, or those producers that are installing feedlot control projects. Whether it's a loan dollar or whether it's a grant dollar, each one of those, we enter into an agreement with that local unit of government. Basically, I guess you could call it a contract for services. And that agreement specifies that exactly what they have to do, and on these work plans, they have to go down and specify, in this case, the number of feedlots that they identified as a high priority, the estimate, and they weren't fully funded for their request. They had to identify those. They have to enter into landowner agreements. Those agreements are enforceable by the local unit of government, and then they're required to financial audit and annual reporting back to the state of Minnesota with the receipt of that money.
And then just to take an example, a city of Plymouth, which would be more of an urban recipient, that was also a loan, or was that a grant?
Mr. Chair, I do need to make one point of clarification, and I kind of forgot about that. We did receive $1 million of bond money last year as part of our appropriation. And that money was, going back to Representative McGinnis's comment, because it was bond in nature, we had to have that public interest. And in this case, the city of Plymouth, it was a phosphorus reduction to Medicine Lake through improvements and enhancements to their stormwater control system right in close vicinity to Medicine Lake. And because that was publicly owned, we were able to provide them with $198,000, and that came out of what's called public interest land grants, and that public interest was kind of the key definition for the use of that $1 million of bond money in that particular case. Same conditions apply with the grant. They had to identify specifically what project they were applying for. They had to provide us with information on the estimated pollution reduction benefits, how they calculated that, what the cost of the improvement was, and then ultimately with the bond, because the life of that is over 20 years, they have to provide us assurance that they have the ability to operate and maintain that facility for the life of the bond, which the state has said is a minimum of 20 years.
I was wondering if you could walk us through the maps that we have there, that you have some county and district applicants, joint powers board applicants, and you have a summary. What generally were the contaminants or the TMDLs? Are these primarily fecal coliform, or and you don't have to be very specific, but just generally when we look at a map, what's the pollutant that we're talking about?
If I could refer you back to this, which I believe was the third page in the handout that we were looking at, the restoration projects, those are the 12 watersheds that had approved TMDL plans. And as you look at those, the lower Mississippi, lower Minnesota, that's basically southeast Minnesota, the south branch of the Yellow Medicine is in far southwestern Minnesota, and if you look at the city and watershed district applicants, the Yellow Medicine River is over there on the left-hand side in that lower left box on your map. So that was a TMDL restoration project. Shingle Creek is metro. Chippewa River is, again, within the Minnesota River. It happened to have a fecal coliform TMDL in the Chippewa River, but also part of the Minnesota River, which had a dissolved oxygen. So as you can see, this first year, we were primarily focused on fecal coliform and dissolved oxygen. Those are the primary ones. Shingle Creek had a chloride, and then there was a couple turbidity, which is basically sediment in the water. And so as you look at the map and the shading of it, is that as you look at the upper left hand, those are primarily projects that were, as you go kind of above the Twin Cities, those are protection activities. Those were projects that came in where they are parts of the state where they said we have high value waters. They were identified as priority waters in a comprehensive local water management plan, and they laid out and proposed projects which would move them towards keeping those waters off by implementing land use practices, helping them with some local regulation in some cases, but basically, again, implementing activities which are land use directed at those activities which are causing that trend to be worsening in a lake, river, or stream, or ones that they've identified through their own local monitoring and assessment, could be through previous Clean Lakes assessment or Clean Water Partnership, and so it's funds to help them implement those. The rest of it, as you can kind of see, which is basically south of the Twin Cities, almost all of those are directly related to a TMDL. Buffalo Creek would be the Minnesota River Dissolved Oxygen. Yellow Medicine was their fecal coliform. And then Shingle Creek is at chloride, and so they were all had an association primarily in the southern half of the state with ATMDL.
Representative Wiggins.
Thank you. Where was the chloride in Shingle Creek coming from?
The chloride in, I think, it's almost all from salt application in the winter time on roads. And so the funding that they're receiving is to help them purchase some experimental technology which will reduce the amount of salt, I think they estimate, by 40% within that watershed by going with some pre-wetting technology and some other application technology which helps them deal with a variable rate application so that they can, rather than have turn the spreader on and have it put on exactly the same amount, you know, as you drive down the road, it actually has the ability to modify that based on road intersections, road conditions, and things like that. So that's what they're attacking in the Shingle Creek Chloride TMDL.
Any other questions? So in summary, we had about $25 million last year, and on a one-time appropriation, where the governor is recommending about $20 million a year, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Which would be less. We had $44 million in requests.
Yeah, under the non-point source activities, that's correct. We had $44 million in requests for funding.
So we had high demand. We've got a lower request per year than what we had last year at one-time dollars. And we're changing a little bit on where the priority goes, where the TMDL development is a higher priority than the point source.
Correct.
And the applicants, the $44 million were not funded this year, they're still in the queue kind of waiting, and do you anticipate there'd be additional requests that come in?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a reasonable conclusion that folks that didn't receive funding will be back applying for funding again, as well as new projects, because as we add TMDLs to that approved plan status, those areas become eligible for the restoration funding as well. So I would expect that you potentially would see an even higher demand. The only thing that might change that is obviously people's attitudes are, you know, they're only, you know, you can run into the situation, I guess, where, you know, people just say, you know, we've applied two or three times and we haven't got it, so we're just going to quit doing it. But we would continue to use a priority ranking system in any scenario to make sure that we're funding those projects that are going to have the greatest success and can demonstrate their ability to reduce those pollutants that are causing those impairments in those watersheds.
So, thank you. That helps a lot for the future. When we're in the budgeting year this year, you are going to wait and to see what we provide. And after July 1st, the process starts again. You'll do another RFP using the same process as you did for the one-time money.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we are going through kind of an evaluation, you know, lessons learned from this year, you know, what worked well, you know, what maybe didn't work so well. But our plan would be to have an annual request for proposal, and the timing of that would probably occur shortly after the beginning of the fiscal year, so that we can get that money out probably, as we try this year, before the first of the year. I think right now we're in the 98% encumbered as far as all the grants that we've encumbered contracts are in. I think we have every contract signed but one. So we try to probably follow the similar kind of a schedule for request for proposal, ranking. Those go to our board for approval, and then working with the individual applicants.
Representative Wiggins.
Can we assume that you receive these applications electronically and that folks can reapply fairly quickly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, yes, they are. It is an electronic application, as well as the reporting, and they're tied together through a program that we've developed, which you hear referred to as E-Link, which is the name we've given it over the years. So they could simply take that old proposal and call it up again in the system and modify, edit, change it, and resubmit it again. As in response to a new RFP. So it would be a fairly straightforward process for them to do that.
Mr. Jaschke.
Mr. Chairman, members, you know, I still remember my date with a local government person a couple of weeks ago, and just, I won't forget that perspective, hopefully, but I can speak, I think, generically, that there will be more interest just because there wasn't a certainty about the money being available at all, and so local government budgets, you know, have to be planned well in advance as well. So some of them are interested in doing more to supplement the state's efforts, but they didn't know what was coming, how much was going to come out, and how it was going to be offered. And so I think, you know, there's a lot more interest than I think we saw in terms of demand, just because of a readiness factor that the local governments need to build into their planning and budgeting as well. So. I know there are a couple of cities that got funded, but my experience is that there's a lot more that are interested if they know that they can see this coming and build it into their local budgets and plan for it.
Okay, thank you. I do see there are some G6C members in the audience. I just want to give any opportunity, if they have any comments on the process for funding this year or any recommendations for the future. They're all looking at each other up there.
John. Mr. Thomas, I'm just wondering, of those 183 projects that may not have been eligible or may have had incomplete applications or had some eligibility problems in their application, do you let them know what those problems are, or do they just know they weren't funded and they don't know how to complete an application next time?
Mr. Chairman, John, the way that we operate it is the RFP itself, or the first response, is fairly short. We try to keep it down to 3-4 pages. The idea behind that is we want to know what are the good projects out there, and don't expect people to be master grant writers at that point in time. We try to ask for enough information to provide the interagency review team the ability to rank and score those proposals. If they're missing something, that's not going to affect them at that point in time. Once they're selected, then we ask them to complete kind of a full-blown application, which is going to go into much more detail, and then we can work out if there's, you know, something was missed or some deficiencies in there. If they can't resolve those at that point, then we make a decision as to and working with them, and then just moved down the priority list to the next project that would be eligible and had requested that type of funding. So we try to accommodate and not eliminate people or eliminate local governments simply because they may not have, you know, the ability to hire a consultant to write a proposal or have a grant writer on staff. We try to make it so that we're actually looking for those good and great proposals that really are going to, you know, have an impact out there.
Representative Wagenius.
One of the things that's very difficult for us to see with Legacy is the context. The governor didn't fully fund what was requested, and so I am trying to figure out, and perhaps you all have done it, how many years it would take to clean up our waters at the pace that we are going if we were to adopt the governor's budget as is. How many years would it take to clean up our waters?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guineas, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question. I think there's a couple parts. One is we continue to find and add waters to the impaired waters list, as you've heard from the Food Control Agency, as we continue to monitor and assess. So that list continues to grow, so that time frame is there. I can, you know, speaking on what the G16 did, they looked at it from the standpoint of what would be reasonable progress, and that's what the federal government looks for, is the state to be making reasonable progress. They came up with a number of $80 million per year that they felt got us towards that. We've done different estimates on different parts of this package. I think we came up with a calculation at one point that if you took the 27 projects, TMDL projects, that would be approved by 2008, I think is the time frame. And we looked at those from a non-point source pollution perspective. I think the estimate was somewhere in the vicinity of about $1 to $1.2 billion. Now, we have to break that down because the federal government, through the federal conservation programs, can accomplish much of that in a targeted fashion. There's a landowner contribution and all of that. But to pin that down to how many years, you know, I certainly am not able to do that. And we can kind of check with maybe the folks at PC if they've tried to do any estimating of that, but I don't believe they have.
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be helpful if PC and DNR and you guys got together and said, this is, I don't know what to tell Minnesota citizens about how we're doing in cleaning up our waters. And we know, we have some big numbers. The PCA knows how many impairments. Mm-hmm. They have an estimate of, I think, about 10,000 impairments. If we can take that estimate and use that and use the work that you've done already and figure out the proportion of, you know, what is it going to take to get the job done is the basic question here. Now, we have asked the PCA for that in terms of the cost to test and do the TMDLs. So I'm not talking about that part. I'm talking about the next part. What is it gonna cost when we get to that part? Because then we'll have to be asking some questions about, do we have to adopt some other strategies? So I think that is a number, and nobody's holding anybody to a dollar amount. Mm-hmm. It's more what is a range of dollars that if we were a steady Eddie on the course that we're going and did the 10,000 impairments, didn't do the testing and TMDLs, but just did the fix the problem, what's the dollars? Is that a fair question?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely it's a fair question, and we will try to, you know, come up with a way to project that. I think we can do it reasonably well with the 12 TMDL studies that are already done, because that's part of what is included in their implementation plans, is an estimate of what that need is. And maybe from that, there might be a way to extrapolate as to, you know, how much might you expect the implementation cost to be each time you add a new, TMDL study completed to the list. So we'll certainly attempt to take a run at that and get some information back.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Dashke and Mr. Thomas, for putting this together on relatively short notice. Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to comment at all? We're here in the end here. We will be meeting again on next Tuesday, same room at 12:30, and we should have the topics posted hopefully by the end of the week. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.